Masechet Baba Kama, Daf Kof Yod Zayin. We left off the end of the previous daf with a rule that if the rabbis impose a fine in one particular case, we cannot assume that they would also impose a fine on a different case that's similar but a bit different. It could be that the rabbis impose it on this particular case. Maybe people are violating this situation a lot, but they wouldn't necessarily apply it in a variant case. That's not the same as monetary compensation. If you're liable to pay because of damages, so and you have another case that's basically similar in all its fundamentals, then if you're responsible in one case, we can derive that you would also be responsible in the other case. So that's the rule. But now we're going to look for a source. How do you know that you cannot derive that you should make a fine in case A from case B, even though they are similar? So look at this baraita de Tanya. These are three examples of indirect damage, where a person is causing damage not by changing the item itself. The item is physically the same, but rather by changing its legal status. So if I go, you have some produce there, and I go and make it tameh. You can't tell from looking at it that it's tameh, but now it's worth less. There are certain people that eat all their food betahara, and they would not buy this anymore. If it's terumah, then even a kohen cannot eat it. He has to burn it. So this is going to reduce its value. Still somewhat valuable, but it's going to reduce its value. I have to pay for that damage. And also, if you have some wine, and I go and take the wine, and I pour it for Avodah Zarah. Now, I made the wine prohibited to drink, prohibited to even get benefit from. So now, I'm reducing its value very substantially. So that at first, the rabbi said, if I cause you damage by making your food tameh, or your yayin into yayin nesech, I have to pay. And then, after some time, the rabbis convened and deliberated again, and they added another category of hamidameya. If you had a kosher food, produce that you can eat, you already took terumah maaser and everything, and I come and I take some terumah from elsewhere and mix it in. So now it can only be eaten by a kohen. The kohen can eat the terumah that's mixed in to it, so that's going to make the price less. Than it was before. So they added that. So what can we derive from here? Chazru in, lo chazru la. You see that the only reason why midameya is added is because the rabbis deliberated again and decided to add that in. But if they had not deliberated and changed their mind, then we would not assume that midameya one has to pay for. Mai ta'ama, la mishum de kenasahu, kenasah la gamrinan mineh. Is this not because this is a fine? See, you can't really call it monetary obligation for damages because there's no physical damage. So how could you charge someone for physical damage if there is none? But it is annoying, and we don't want people to go around and make other people's food tameh and all that. So the rabbis made a knas. However, just because you have two categories of knas, so we cannot by ourselves assume that it would apply to a third similar category, unless the rabbis specifically come and say, you know what, we're going to apply knas to this too. So you see from this case that we do not derive a fine from one case to another. Isn't that a good proof? And we answer no. La mei karas sabre lehefsed merube hasheshu. Lehefsed mu'at lo hasheshu. Ulbasof sabre lehefsed mu'at name hasheshu. No, at the beginning they said, you know what? We have to make a fine when it's a lot of damage. In the first two cases, where you take food and make it tameh, there's lots of people that want their food to be tahor. And so now, making it tameh, it's reducing the value a lot. Yayin esech, you're reducing the value to zero. So in those two cases where there's a big loss, that's when they made a fine. But but we would not necessarily, logically, derive that midameya if you make added some terumah. Okay, it can still be eaten by kohanim. So there's not a big loss. So we would have thought that we would not impose such a loss. And so that's why even if we do derive one knas to another case, here we would not necessarily have done so because the loss is not as great. So that's why they would not have imposed it in that case. Okay. Ini veha tane avud Rabbi Avin. Barishona yomrim hametame vehamedameya hazru lomar af hamenasech hazru in lo hazru la. Hold on. We have another version of this braita from Abu Rabbi Avin, who said at first it was the categories were different. At first the rabbis decided that taught that if you make someone else's food tameh or you add terumah into their food, then you have to pay for it. And only later they said, you know what? Also, if you make it yayin nesech, you see here, you can't say what you said before because yayin nesech is actually the biggest loss. So it doesn't make sense that we wouldn't be able to figure out that if these two metameh and medameya, which are partial loss, if you have to pay a fine, then all the more so you should have to pay a fine in menasech. So the only reason why the one who pours it out a libation is prohibited is because they revisited the topic and changed their mind. But otherwise, it wouldn't be. Isn't that a proof that we cannot, by ourselves, through logic, derive one fine from another? So that's a good proof. No, it's because at first they were following the opinion of Rabbi Abin, and then they followed the opinion of Rabbi Yirmiyah. We're going to explain what these two sages said in a second, but the basic idea is that according to Rabbi Avin, when you pour the yayin nesech, you're actually chayav mita for doing avodah zara. And since you're liable to capital punishment, so that's why you didn't have to pay. That was at first, they said, you don't have to pay because you get capital punishment. But then they changed their minds and they realized actually you are liable to capital punishment and to the monetary obligation at different times. And therefore, we do not apply kim lebedrabamine. So Rabbi Avin and Rabbi Mia, we're not actually talking about this case, but a different case, and we're applying the same principle. Mekara sabrek Rabbi Avin, damar Rabbi Avin, zarak chetz metechilat arba ulbasof arba, vekara shirain vahalichato, patur, shere akira, sorech anachahi, umitchayev benafsho. Someone on Shabbat threw an arrow from in public domain from the beginning of Faramot to the end of Faramot. So that is carrying. You know, to violate carrying, it's not only if you're carrying and walking, also if you throw something Faramot, one is liable. Now, on the way, in the middle, there was a silk garment that belonged to somebody else, and it tore through the silk garment, causing monetary damage. So, according to the Rabbi Avin, the thrower is not liable. Why? Because even though you only violate Shabbat when you do both actions, you pick it up and send it across, right? And then it goes down. So it has to complete the full travel in order to be liable. However, the Rabbi Avin says since the picking up, that's the throwing, was for the purpose of it landing, right? You can see the trajectory and is going to land past four amot. So therefore, one is liable for the entire trip, not only when it lands, but even from the beginning to the end of the trip. It's one long death penalty requirement it's one long act for which one is liable death penalty. And since the tearing of the other person's garment happened during the same action for which one is liable death penalty, therefore one does not have to pay. And it's the same thing here. Since this perpetrator picked up someone else's wine flask and poured it to Yayin Nesech. Now that action is one, it takes some time. You have to, there's different steps. You pick it up, right, and then you pour it. So nevertheless, we consider it all one action, and therefore the stealing happened at the same time as the Yayin Nesech, and since Yayin Nesech, you're Chayav Mita, therefore you're not liable for stealing it. Stealing is done when you pick it up, but that's all part of the same action according to Rabbi Avin. That's what they thought at first, and that's why they said that you don't have to pay for making someone else's wine, yayin nesach. But then when the rabbis deliberated again, they decided differently. They ended up ruling like it'd be miyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah would say, he doesn't quote what he says about Shabbat here, but he would say that in the Shabbat case, you're liable because when you throw it, right, you didn't do anything yet because you only threw it. It didn't land. So then it rips the silk at this moment, and you're liable to pay, and you only chayav mita later on when it lands, right? Because so these are two actions separated in time. In this case also, this perpetrator, when he lifts up someone else's wine, he's already liable to for stealing. And so that's it. That liability stays. And the prohibition of Yayin Nesech is only when he pours the libation onto, you know, some altar or wherever he's pouring it in order to do that Avodah Zarah. It's only at the time of pouring that he is Chayav Mita. Since these are two different actions separated in time, he is liable to both. That's why they changed their minds. But it's not because you can't derive one fine from another. In both of these baraitot, there was a reason to not apply the fine in that third case, whichever it was. And so we end up with not having a proof for this law that you cannot derive a fine in one case for another equal or even more serious case. Although that does remain the rule, or even if these are not proofs. Rav Huna bar Yehuda ikla lebe abiyone. Ata lekame de Rava amar le klum ase baliyadcha. So Rav Huna bar Yehuda came to this certain town, be abiyone, and Rava was there. So he met him, and Rava said, "Any interesting cases come to you as a judge?" Amar le, he said, "Yes, here's a case. Yisrael shah anasuhu goyim, ve'rav amon chavero baliyadi ve'chiyavtiv." There was a Jew that said, Gentiles coerced him and said, "Show us some property because we want to steal." This particular Jew, maybe he didn't have much property. So they said, "You know the community here, right? Show us some rich person that we can go and steal from him." And so this Jew, although he was coerced, what can he do? So he showed them it. And then, so the robbers, those thugs, they took the stuff. They're gone. But now the owner who was robbed from, right, sued this Jew as an informer. And the case came to Rav Huna bar Yehuda, and he said, "You're liable, right? You pointed the thieves to this guy's house, so you have to pay." So he made the Jewish informer pay. So he told this to Rava. Rava said, "Amar le ahadar ubadar le mare." Rava said, "You made the wrong decision. You reversed your decision, right? And the money has to go back." The informer did not have to pay. The Tanya, Yisrael shanasu goyim ve'ram amon chavero patur, v'im natal v'natan bayad chayav. We have a beraita that says a Jew who under coercion shows some non-Jewish thieves where money is of his friend, does not have to pay because he was coerced, unless he takes an active part in going and taking it and bringing it. Let's say the non-Jewish robber says, go to someone's house, a rich person, and bring some money for us. If he does that, then the Jew is liable because there he's taking an active part in actually stealing the item and handing it over. So that's a direct damage. But if it's only by words, this is what it has in common with what we came before, what was there before. This is indirect damage. The informer just told them where the money is, but they're the ones that did the stealing, and it was coercion, then he's not liable to pay. Rabbi adds another criteria of liability, that if the Jewish informer volunteers the information, right? He sees some guys running around. He says, "Hey guys, are you looking for some money? I know where it is," right? They don't force him to do so. Yeah, this is a pretty evil guy that he goes and informs and tells thieves where money is. So then that's the same as if the Jew went and physically himself took it from that rich person's house and brought it to the thieves, and one would be liable. All right, based on these principles, let's look at a few more cases.
Rav
patrine. So we have an interesting combination of these principles. A certain guy and these non-Jewish thugs came and they coerced him and said, show us some money. And he said, oh, that Rav Mari, the son of Pinchas, son of Rav Chista, he has some good wine, very expensive wine, right? That's you can go get some good property there. And they said he brought them there. And then they said, listen, we want you to also help us carry the wine with us. A lot of wine here, right? So we want forcing him to be an accomplice to carry the wine out. And so he did. He carried it and brought it with them. The case came before Rav Asher, Rav Mari, the owner of the wine, said, this guy, this Jewish informer, he should pay me. Number one, he told them that I have wine and showed them where it is. Second, he actually carried it out. Rav Asher said, no, he doesn't have to pay. Amru le Rabbanan le Rav Asher, v'hatanya im nasav natan bayad chayav. So the rabbis asked Rav Asher, why'd you say he doesn't have to pay? Don't we have a braita that says if the Jewish informer actually himself manually transported the stolen items, then he has to pay? In this case, he did. So Rav Asher said, that's only if the Jew did not show them the property at the outset. The non-Jew was somewhere in the street. They said, go bring us some property that we want to steal. But they don't know where it is, so they don't have access to it directly. The Jew himself goes, breaks in, takes the stuff and brings it to them. That's when that baraita said that the Jewish informer has to pay. However, if the non-Jewish bandits were already there, and so they could have taken it themselves, then once they know the spot, it's already as if it's gone, it's burnt, and so it's already worthless, it's already stolen. And so there, the Jew just helping out to do some manual labor to carry it, that is not considered stealing. So in this case, we actually have a combination of factors that explain Rav Asher's ruling. Number one, they forced him to point to where some valuable stuff was. So since he was coerced, the Jewish informer is not liable, right? We said, you better show us where some money is or else. And so he said, okay, here's Rav Mari's house. Here's his wine cellar, right? Okay, so for that, he's not liable. And once they're there, now these non-Jews, they have access to it on their own. So it's considered already stolen, already gone. So what this guy did later by carrying it is not significant. And therefore, Rav Asher said, he does not have to pay. We challenge Rav Asher, however. Rabbi Abu challenged Rav Asher's ruling. Amal from this baraita, Amal lo anas. Hoshet li pekia om amir ze, o eshkol anavim ze, v'oshit lo hayav. If a thug tells a Jew, hey, pass me that bundle of grain, pass me that cluster of grapes, and he does, he passes it to him, he is liable, even though the thug is right there, and presumably the thug could get it himself, right? Isn't this talking about a case where he could get it himself, and yet the Jew should not participate? If the Jew coerced, under coercion, indirectly says words and says, you know, go to the corner and turn the right, it's over there. Okay, but here it is not liable. But here, where he's actively taking the stuff, he is liable, even though the thugs were there. So how could you make this distinction, Rav Asher? And the answer is, no, this baraita is talking about a case where the thugs and the Jew are on two sides of a river. The Jew is on the side of the river where someone's clusters of grapes are. The thug is on the other side. The thug can't get it because on the other side of the river, but he says, hey, pass me that. And in this case, the Jew could just say, no, run away. You don't have to do it. But instead, he says, okay, I'll help you out, even though the Jew himself isn't keeping the stuff, but he's actively doing something that allows the thug to be able to steal it. So this would be the same as if the thug was, on the street and said, go get me some stolen goods. And he goes and gets it. So that's why he's liable. And actually, We're not just backing into this interpretation, but it makes sense in the choice of verb. Hoshit means to pass, right? And not just give. If he was right there, he would just say, give it to me. But the fact that he has to pass it over means he has to stretch out his hand to pass over the river. Hahu shuta, tavu minsu ala betre. One time there was two Jews fighting over a net, a fishing net. Hai amar didihu, hai amar didihu. This was mine. The other one said, is mine. One of these two Jews went and gave it to the non-Jewish officer of the king, right? And he said, here, you take care of it, figure out who it belongs to. So basically, he is kind of like a Jewish informer giving it to a thug, which he's actively doing this. The thugs weren't there. We're treating the officer like a thug. And because they probably would just confiscate it. If we apply the rules above, then we would say, hey, you took something that half a chance that it belongs to someone else, and you passed it over with your hands to a thug. So should he be liable? Abaya says, no, he's not liable, because since we don't know whose it is, so the guy who gave it to the non-Jewish official can say, I gave him my own thing. He claimed that the net is his, and so he gave over something that belongs to him. Therefore, he's not liable. Amale Rava, Kol kemine ela amar Rava mishamtinan le'ad maitele ve'ka'e bedina. Says, is that in his power to decide that he's the owner? Who says he's the owner? That he can say, oh, I'm the owner, I gave it to him. We didn't decide yet who the owner is. It's under dispute. And therefore, we should excommunicate that person until he gets it back from that officer and brings it to a bedin, and we'll decide who is right and who is wrong. You can always give away your own stuff if you know it's yours, but if you're giving away something that's in dispute, then that also is not permitted. Okay, now we have the beginning of a long and very interesting and deep story of a person. He wanted to be an informer, a Jew who wanted to inform on others, maybe to gain favor from the government official or from this mafia guy. So he wanted to show someone else's straw to the Gentiles or Gentile authorities. Maybe he was angry at this fellow Jew. So Atala kamed Rav, and he came to Rav. Amar le la tachvi ve la tachvi. Rav says, no, you're not allowed to do that. Do not show someone else, even though you're not physically stealing it yourself. You're not allowed to be informer so that someone else will come and take the straw of your neighbor. Amar le machvin o machvin. And the guy says, I'm going to show it. Why did he ask Rav in the first place if he's not going to listen to him? Not sure, but maybe he happened to be there and he says, you know, I'm going to do this. And he's threatening. So Yativ Rav Kahana kamed Rav Shamte Lekoe Mine. So Rav Kahana was a student of Rav, and he happened to be sitting there, right? They were studying together while this was happening, and Rav Kahana saw this guy. What kind of disrespectful thing this is. Number one, he contradicts Rav, the great sage, and he's going to be a Jewish informer, get someone in trouble. Who knows? Once they take his hay, and then maybe they'll kill him too. All right, this is very dangerous to be an informer against someone else, to some mafia. So Rav Kahana dislodged the man's neck from him, broke his neck, his head fell off, and he killed this Jewish informer. Okay, already we see something about Rav Kahana and his zeal. Rav justified what his student Rav Kahana did through a pasuk in Yeshaya that says, your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of the streets like an antelope in the net. Why are they compared to an antelope caught in a net? Just like an antelope that falls in the net, the hunter is not going to have mercy on it. He'll go and kill it. He's not going to just, you know, take something from it. So too, once money of a Jew falls into that of non-Jewish thugs, they're not going to have mercy. They're not going to just take some of his money. It's like, okay, we have enough. You can keep the rest. Rather, once they see this guy has money, they're going to take everything he has, and then they're going to kill him too to make sure he doesn't complain, so that they justify taking all his money. So therefore, this Jewish informer, right, I don't know what he was thinking, but he was about to get this guy in big trouble and not only take his hay, but also maybe have that guy killed. So being an informer, this informer deserved what he got.
אמר לרב כהנה עד העידנה הוו פרסאי דלה קפתי השפיכות עמים והשתאיקה יבנאה תקפתו השפיכות עמים ואמרי מרדין מרדין קום סקלר עד ישראל וקביל הלך דלה תקשר רבי יוחנן שבא שנין.
So Rav told Rav Kahana, even though you were justified in killing this bad informer, nevertheless you need to run away, because until now the Persians were in charge and they didn't care about murder, but now the Greeks are in charge and they do care about murder, and they're going to say murderer, murderer. And now, in order to understand this, we actually first have to look at the Girsaot, because the order of these two dynasties is different. In the printed editions, it was the top three lines, and also in two manuscripts down here, it has, as we just read, that first there were the Persians, and then there were the Greeks afterwards. However, this is incorrect. The correct version is in these two manuscripts, Hamburg and Munich manuscript, that says, originally, we had the Greek Empire, who did not care about murder, but now we are under the Persians who do. Okay, what is this referring to? We're talking about we're in Babylonia, where the Greeks never ruled over Babylonia. The Romans did not rule over it. Rather, it was always under the Persians. However, there were two different Persian dynasties. The first one's called the Parthians, and then in the year 226, the Sasanian dynasty took over, and they ruled differently. The Parthians had more Greek influence. That's why it calls them the Greeks. They were more Hellenized, so that's why it refers to it as the Greeks. The Parthians ruled in a feudal way, like feudalism. Every ethnicity group, they had their own semi-autonomy, and therefore, if one Jew would hurt or kill another Jew, or the same thing with any other ethnicity or group within their empire, they left it up to the locals. As you deal with it, right? You have your own, just pay us taxes and you deal with your own civil and criminal cases. So therefore, under the Parthians, if one Jew killed another, then it would be the people in charge, the Jews in charge, would take care of it, the Resh Galuta, the courts there. And so in this case, since Rav Kahana was justified and Rav was the great rabbi, he's like, oh, you'll be okay. Under the Parthians, you'd be okay, and we would, we would figure it out. However, now, and this happened actually during Rav's lifetime, the Sasanians took over, and the Sasanians ruled more directly. And they could, oh, there's a murder? What's going on here? Who did the murder? They're going to find out about it. They're going to come investigate, and they're going to arrest you. They're going to call you a murderer. So therefore, it's not safe for you here. You have to run away and go to Israel. Now Rav has a piece of advice. Listen, when you go to Israel, the Gadol Hadod in the land of Israel is Rabbi Yochanan. He's undisputed. He's like almost all the sages in Israel are students of Rabbi Yochanan, to the extent that Rambam even says Rabbi Yochanan wrote the Talmud Yerushalmi. It's not literally true, because there's many generations after Rabbi Yochanan, but they're all from his school. Okay, so listen, Rav Kahana, I know you. You're very zealous. You ask great questions. You're very challenging, and that's okay in Bavel. That's the way we learn in Bavel, right? Everybody challenges each other. Even students ask strong questions to their teachers, right? And that's how we sharpen each other. That's the way that education was done in Bavel. However, now you're going to a new land. You're in Eretz Israel. First of all, you're a foreigner. You're running away from murder. And in Eretz Israel, they're more civilized. The way that they learn is more by memorization. They also do, questions and answers, all that, but you have to be respectful. So here, I want you to promise that you're not going to ask any questions to Rabbi Yochanan for 7 years. 7 years, he's got to keep quiet, learn from Rabbi Yochanan. He is the Gadol Hador, but don't ask anything. They're going to see it as being disrespectful. Okay, Rav Kahana has no choice. He's running for his life. Azil Ashkachel Resh Lakish Deyatib Vekamisayim Metibta Deyoma LeRabanan. So he goes to Eretz Yisrael and he sees Resh Lakish. Resh Lakish was a Chevruta, but also younger student. of Rabbi Yochanan, and Rish Lakish was reviewing the daily lecture of Rabbi Yochanan in front of the other students. You know, Rabbi Yochanan would give his shiur, and it needed elaboration because it was very high level, and so Rish Lakish was explaining it. And so Rav Kahana is there, and he gets there in time to overhear Rish Lakish's explanation of review of Rabbi Yochanan's shiur. Amar lehu Rish Lakish. So he goes to some students and he says, where's Rish Lakish? The students are like, why do you want to know? And Rav Kahana started saying, because I heard what he was saying, and I have this difficulty and this challenge, and I have this answer and that resolution. So already Rav Kahana, I see he can't contain himself, but he's not challenging Rabbi Yochanan directly. That's okay. He's talking to other students. He's like, you know, I have these questions. Probably he did know where Rish Lakish was, but he didn't want to confront Rish Lakish either, or maybe Rish Lakish already left the room. So he's talking to the students. Now the students report that to Rish Lakish. Amru le Rish Lakish, Azel Shakish amar le Rabbi Yochanan, Ari ala mi bavel, ayin mor bim tibeta del mahar. And so the students tell Rish Lakish, oh, listen, there was this student around from Bavel. He asked a lot of questions. Rish Lakish then reports it to Rabbi Yochanan. And he says, a lion has come up from Bavel. He made aliyah. And so he's going to have a lot of big questions on the shiur today. He was already asked challenging at getting other answers, proofs, disproofs. Rabbi Yochanan, my teacher, master, you should examine your shiur for tomorrow. I'm sure Rabbi Yochanan was always well prepared, but he's like, tomorrow, be extra well prepared. Be right, just in case Rav Kahana came. He's a lion. He's going to really challenge you, right? Make sure to be on the top of your game. Now the way it worked in the shiur is that when the teacher was in front and the students were in rows behind him, and the front row was the top students, and then behind the last row was the least of the students. So since he already got a reputation of being a lion, they put him in the front row. Amar shema ateta vela ikshe. Rabbi Yochanan says a halacha. Rav Kahana sitting there quietly. Shema teta v'lakshe. Another question. Rav Kahana doesn't say anything. An hater achore shema dare ad otbe bedara batra. As the shiur is going on, they kept demoting Rav Kahana, right? Back because he's quiet. He's not saying. Other people are saying good insights, and he doesn't say anything. So they demote him all the way in the back, and you can imagine Rav Kahana, this zealous rabbi, how he's feeling, and he feels very demeaned and humiliated because he does have questions. He's holding back. Amar le Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Arisha Amarta Nasa Shual. And after the lecture, or towards the end of the lecture, Rabbi Yochanan tells Rish Lakish, oh, this lion that you said to warn me about, he became a fox. He's docile. So he can't even say one thing the whole shiur. He's nothing. You got me scared about him. Amar, Rav Kahana hears that. Reher ava dehani sheba dare lehu chiluf sheba shenin damar li rav. Rav Kahana said, I know I promised I wasn't going to ask any questions for 7 years, but may it be God's will that these seven rows, right? There were seven rows altogether. He's all the way in the last row. These seven rows that they demoted me should be in the place of 7 years, right? That's it. Enough is enough. I can't keep quiet anymore. Kam akar'e amar le ni hadar mo. So Rav Kahana, he's all the way in the back, all humiliated. He can't take it anymore. He stands up on his feet and says, all right, to Rabbi Yochanan, start the whole lecture again. Go all the way back to the beginning. Rewind. Rabbi Yochanan does. And so Rabbi Yochanan says the halacha. Rav Kahana challenges him. And so then they bring him up now the rows, right? Next row. Now he's all the way in the front row. And Rav Kahana says the next halacha. And Rav Kahana asks a bomb question and challenges him. Rabbi Yochanan hava yateb asheba bistarkeh. Rabbi Yochanan was sitting on top of seven cushions, right? To be higher than everybody else. He's on these cushions. As an aside, bistarkeh is a Persian word. And these cushions are known from other Persian documents that a judge would sit on cushions to show his physical height was parallel to his stature. This is just one of several Persian words and Persian themes and things that made sense in Persia, but they weren't true in Eretz Yisrael. Another one is the number of rows. In Eretz Yisrael, max, there were 3 rows in the yeshivot there of 23. That's in the big yeshiva, was 3 times 23, 69, plus the teacher was 70, like the Sanhedrin. And it's only in evidence from Bavel, later times, that they were these 7 rows. So there's a lot of things here that show that the story is told from a Persian point of view. I'll get back to the significance of that when we finish the story. Shalfile hada bistarka mitute. So now Rabbi Yochanan is teaching. He says halacha. Rav Kahana challenges him, and so they take away one cushion, make Rabbi Yochanan a little lower. Amash matatavak shile ad shalfile kulehu bistarke mitute ad yativ al ara. And every time Rav Kahana had another challenge, they took away another cushion from under Rabbi Yochanan until Rabbi Yochanan was all the way down on the floor. And again, you don't have to take the details of the story literally. The point is, right, he's Rabbi Yochanan is being humiliated, degraded before this student, newcomer from Bavel, who's asked, challenging in this way. Rabbi Yochanan gabra saba hava umasreche gebine amalehu deluli yainai ve'echzeye delule bemachalta teh kaspa. Rabbi Yochanan was very old, and his eyebrows were drooping down, so he couldn't see very much. There's a chronological problem here, because Rav died several decades before Rabbi Yochanan, and so it wouldn't make sense that Rabbi Yochanan was very old when Rav was still alive. That we'll come back to that also to figure out the meaning of this story. But the point is that not all the details can be verified. Anyway, he said, pick up my eyebrows so I can see who this is. And so they bring a silver stick that was used to paint eyes, like put eyeliner on, and they picked up his eyebrows. The idea is that he's so honored that the students weren't going to just touch him. They use a silver stick, right, befitting his high stature. Vate. Rabbi Yochanan sees that his lips were split. Rav Kahana had a dry lips, and there was split in the middle. Savar achuch dem kamechayech be chalashta teve nachnafshe. Rabbi Yochanan, seeing that Rav Kahana's lip was split, that's just the way he looked, but Rabbi Yochanan thought that he was laughing, mocking him, like, ha ha ha, right? I got you. I stumped you so many times. See, I'm better than you. Rav Kahana was very upset. Rabbi Yochanan was very upset, offended by this, and it's never a good idea to offend a great sage. As a result of Rabbi Yochanan being offended, Rav Kahana died. All right, you see that we're coming back to the beginning of the story when Rav Kahana killed a Jewish informer for being insolent to Rav and speaking him in that way. Rav Kahana himself now gets killed for being insolent to Rabbi Yochanan, although he wasn't trying to be disrespectful, but through his zealous questions and then this mocking lip smile that he actually wasn't trying to do, but Rabbi Yochanan thought it was, Rav Kahana himself is killed. Now we understand the wisdom of Rav's advice. Don't ask any questions for 7 years. Rav knew this, saw this coming from miles away, literally. Lemachar amar lehu Rabbi Yochanan l'rabanan. Hazitu lebabla'a hechi avid. Rabbi Yochanan, next day, he's still, you know, upset about it. He tells the rabbis, did you see that Babylonian, how he behaved towards me, how disrespectful he was? But the Rabbi Yochanan student said, actually, not so. Amru le darkehachi, says that's his way. That's just his appearance. He has a cleft lip, right? He wasn't trying to mock you. So now Rabbi Yochanan felt bad that he killed him. Al legabe me'arta haza dehava hadra le achna. So Rabbi Yochanan goes to the cave. Often they buried not underground, but in a cave. With a stone or covering it. And so he goes there to go in the cave, but there's a serpent, a snake surrounding it, blocking it. Rashi explains that the snake had its tail in its mouth so that it was locked and he couldn't get in. Amale achna achna petach pume vikanes harav esel tamid. So Rabbi Yochanan says, snake, oh snake, open your mouth and let a teacher come in to visit the student. Vela petach, but it didn't open. Yikanes chaver esel chaver. ha'ed v'la patach. Says, let a colleague come and visit a colleague, but still the snake did not open its mouth. Yikanes tamid esel harav petach le be'adach ameh ve'ukmeh. Not until Rabbi Yochanan himself, humiliated himself, humbled himself, and said, let a student come before the teacher. Rabbi Yochanan, can you imagine, has to call Rav Kahana, this Babylonian, his teacher. Only then did the snake open its mouth and let him into the cave. Ba'ad ha-chameh ve'ukmeh, Rabbi Yochanan prayed for rachamim from Hashem and brought Rav Kahana back up from the dead. So that's the benefit of being great sage. They're dangerous and they kill people, but they also bring them back to life. So that's good. Amar le'i havaya da'ana de'darkeh de'mor hachi la'chalsha da'ati. So Rabbi Yochanan apologizes. If I knew that this is just the way you look and you weren't trying to mock me, I would not have been offended and lost my cool and been depressed about your questions. All right, I would have accepted your questions. So now please come with us, right? Come back to the Bet Midrash. We're inviting you back. Says on one condition. If you could pray that I'm not going to die again, then I'll come with you, right? I don't want the same thing to happen. I'm going to keep asking questions, so you better be prepared. And I don't want you to go and pray for me to die again. In fact, I want you to pray for me to live, right? And guarantee that you're not going to get upset and you're not going to kill me again. If you can't do guarantee that, I'm not coming with you. I'll just stay. I may as well just stay here. I'm already here. Since the time for death has passed, it's been passed. You can understand this in two ways. Either, since you already killed me, let me stay dead, because otherwise you're just going to kill me tomorrow. I'm already here, don't bother. Or, right, since you brought me back to life, I'm brought back to life. I'm not going to rely on a miracle every day that you're going to kill me and then bring me back to life. So Rabbi Yochanan awakened him. So he was, before that, he was like still kind of dead, but he was just asking him, like, you know, can you come with me? So he totally brought him back to life. He stood up, and then Rabbi Yochanan asked Rav Kahana about every doubtful case that he could think of, every question, and Rav Kahana answered all the questions. Haynu da'amar Rabbi Yochanan, dilchon amri, dilhon hi. And this is why Rabbi Yochanan used to say, that which is yours is really theirs. He would tell students, all this Torah that's yours here in Eretz Yisrael really comes from Bavel. They are more knowledgeable than we are. That's the end of the story. Okay, this is just an amazing, fantastic, such a deep story. So many layers to it. One layer is the chiasm, right? It starts off with Rav Kahana murdering someone. Then Rav Kahana is lowered because he has to, you know, be like, go all the way to the back. And then there's a change. He says, right, chiluf, may the being humiliated in the back be exchanged for the 7 years. And so he changes his mind. And now Rav Kahana is raised up. Rabbi Yochanan is lowered. And then Rav Kahana himself is murdered. So you see the midah keneged midah from the beginning and the end of the story. Okay, that's one part of it. There is a parallel story in the Talmud Yerushalmi. In fact, in Talmud Yerushalmi, that's in Eretz Yisrael and is written earlier. And you can see from this story, I'm not gonna read it now, but you could look at it on your own. It's a very simple story of Rav Kahana one time moving to Eretz Yisrael, nothing, no murder or anything, no one gets killed. Rav Kahana moves to Eretz Yisrael. He has a hard time there adjusting because people are making fun of him, giving him a hard time, and he changes his mind and he goes back. That's it. Very simple story. None of this matters about Rabbi Yochanan humbling himself and asking Rabbi Yochanan asking Rav Kahana questions and saying all of our Torah really belongs to Bavel, right? You don't have any of that there. Instead, this is a very important article by Professor Daniel Sperber on the unfortunate adventures of Rav Kahana, in which he proves that so many of the words and phrases and references and reality people all show that this is a later version of the story. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the historical, or closer to the historical version, and it's the Bavli, the Babylonian storytellers that are adding another layers to the story in order to make a following point. There was always a big a lot of competition between the sages and the yeshivot in Eretz Yisrael versus those of Bavel. The point of this storytelling is to say that Bavel is better. And even Rabbi Yochanan, the greatest sage of Eretz Yisrael, one time when one of our great sages, Rav Kahana, went there, right? He showed him, Rav Kahana showed, it's really not just about the two geographies, but also the style of learning in Eretz Yisrael, more memorizing. In Bavel, the strong challenges, which if you weren't used to it, might seem like being disrespectful, but that's the way they sharpened each other in Bavel. And so this is a story written and told in Bavel, probably not written, but by heart, taught and retold in Bavel to say our system, our Torah is better, and they're imagining Rabbi Yochanan even having to admit at the end, says, yes, you're the source of Torah. We, all of our Torah comes from you. But I doubt that Rabbi Yochanan himself would have been so happy with this story. Okay, a lot more to say about that, but we must go on. Hahu de'achve ametakesa de'rabbi Abba. Yatib Rabbi Abhu v'rabbi Chanina bar Papi v'rabbi Yisrak napacha v'yatib Rabbi Il'a gabayhu. There was a certain Jewish informer that told some non-Jewish thugs about Rabbi Abba's silk. And he said, oh, Rabbi Abba, he has expensive silk. You can go and steal it. Now he was brought to judgment by the owner of Rabbi Abba, right? This guy, he pointed them to me, he should pay. Yeah, so Rabbi Abhu, Rabbi Chanina bar Papi, and Rabbi Yitzchak bar Napacha were all sitting in judgment. They were that was the court, and happened to be Rabbi Allah was among them, nearby, listening. So they said, oh, this guy in Jewish Informer, he caused the damage indirectly, but nevertheless, he should be liable. And they're going to derive this as a proof from a Mishnah in Bechorot that says, if a judge issued a ruling that was mistaken, so he issued a judgment and he said he acquitted someone who's liable, or he said someone's liable who really should have been acquitted, or they said something is tameh that was tahor, or they said something is tahor that was tameh, and then they realized their mistake after. So since they already gave a ruling, so the ruling stands, and whatever, right, they made A pay B, $100, but it turns out unjustly A didn't have to pay. The ruling stands and B keeps the money, and the judge has to go to his own pocket and pay A back for what they made him shell out. And so here, the judge did not do anything. He just talked. He just gave a ruling. And yet, because he gave a mistaken ruling, it's indirect damage, nevertheless, he has to pay. So too, this Jewish informer, although he doesn't physically steal anything, by letting the thugs know where the silk was, he caused indirect damage, and he does have to pay. So that's what the three judges say. But Rabbi Ilah, who was sitting nearby, contradicted them and said, Rav said that this Mishnah, that the judge has to pay, is only if the judge actually took the $100 out of A's hands and gave it to B. In that case, because the judge physically took the money from A, and it was unjust because they gave a wrong ruling, that's why they have to take out of their pocket and give it back, because they physically removed it. That wasn't indirect, that was direct damage. But otherwise, if it was only words, then he wouldn't have to. Therefore, you can actually not prove from this Mishnah that indirect damage is something you have to pay for, and therefore, you have no proof that you should make the Jewish informer pay. Nevertheless, the judges felt that the Jewish informer should pay, they just didn't have a legal basis, a proof, to issue the ruling. So they suggested that Abba, the victim, go to a different court. Go to their court because they say that one has to pay for indirect damage. So they'll give a ruling, and you know, I guess they assume that they do have a basis, and they couldn't give a ruling themselves, but go there. So he did go there, and they in fact did have a proof from our very Mishnah that we started off with in the previous daf, that if the robbers see something, if someone, something, if the thugs come and take something because of a robber, then the robber, in other words, we saw a case where a robber steals something, and then some foreign thugs come and steal from the robber himself. So we see, if we decide, if they stole that because of the robber, if there was a massive army that came and took everybody's field, then that local robber does not have to pay because it would have been taken anyway. However, if they took this specific one because of the robber, then that robber has to pay back, the local robber has to pay back the Jew. And we explain that that's actually talking about not someone, a robber who actually took his friend's field, but rather that he informed some foreign thugs that, oh, this guy has a good field, and by showing it to them, he becomes liable. And so you see, this Mishnah, as long as you interpret it as someone not actually stealing but informing, says is liable, is a good proof for our case as well. Hahu gabda dehava mifkid le kasad chaspa siliku ganabe ilave shekalav yhabu lehu ata lekamer deraba petare. There was a guy who was holding a silver cup for a friend. It was deposited there. He's holding it. Thieves came and he gave it to them. Thieves come, give us something. Where's your valuables? He said, oh, I have the silver cup. Okay. So the case came to Rabba, and Rabba said, told the homeowner who was holding the cup that he does not have to pay, because they came and they forced him. So he's coerced. Amar le Abaye, ha masil asmo ba'amon chavero hu. But Abaye challenged that ruling and said, yeah, but he was saving his own property with his friend's property. This guy, he probably has a lot of silver in his house. He has 10 silver cups. And so the thief came and said, right, give us something valuable. The homeowner could have chosen his own silver cup and give it to him, and then they would have gone on their way. Instead, he took his friend's silver cup. So really, he should have to pay for it. Ela amarav asher chazen ani inish amidhu adata didehu atu v'ila adata dechaspa atu. So therefore, Rav Asher says, actually, it depends on the situation. We go and look at this guy, the homeowner. If he's a wealthy person, then it's likely that the thieves came to his house because they heard he's a wealthy person and they wanted his money, and so therefore he will have to pay because they came to steal his money, not the owner of that particular cup. However, if he's not a wealthy person and probably doesn't have any silver or anything important in his home, expensive is in his home, then presumably the thieves came because they heard that he is holding a silver cup for someone else. So they came particularly for that silver cup that belongs to someone else, and he gave it over to them. He was forced, and therefore he is not liable. So that's an important principle, that you cannot save your own property at the expense of someone else. If really you were the victim of the attack, then you can't send them away with other people's money. He had a guy, and the purse of the redemption funds, the community collected money to redeem captives. Every so often, someone taken captive, so he held the money in his house. Thieves came to his house. He says, what am I going to do? They're forcing me. They said, you know, give us some money or else. He took the purse that belongs to the community fund of redeeming captives, and he gave it to the thieves. And so now the case came to Rava. He said, you're not liable. They forced you, right? And you gave them money to get them away. So that's okay. Abaye asked the same question. Yeah, but he's saving his own life with other people's money. Why didn't he give them his own money? Why should he give other people's money? He should have to replace the money of the community. Rava has a good answer. What was that money collected for? Redeeming captives. This is a great case of redeeming captives. If they didn't give him anything, they would have taken him away. Who knows? Beat him up. And so this he used the money for exactly its purpose. So if it was collecting for something else, maybe not. But this was collected in order to save a captive. And this guy basically was taken captive by these thugs. He had a certain guy. The people are boarding onto a ferry. He comes first on the line. He wants to make sure to get on. And he brings his donkey also. You know, it's like you're getting onto an elevator. Someone has, giant suitcases, and he goes first and takes up all the room. And so now the donkey is moving around, walking around, and is going to cause the boat to sink. Atu hahu gabram elach le lechamra tehavu gabrash veshadye lenahara utba. Someone else who is on the boat comes and pushes the donkey of that guy or into the river, and the donkey drowned and died. Atala kamer to Rabba, the case came to Rabba. Pitare says, you're exempt. Right, this donkey was threatening everybody's life, so you pushed it over. It's his problem. Yeah, but he saved his life at the expense of someone else's property, right? So same principle as before. So shouldn't he have to pay? Okay, very good. You saved your life, but it was at the expense of someone else's property. So pay him, right? You could have done it. You don't have to die and get, you know, drown because of a donkey, but you still should pay for the damage you caused this guy. However, Rava said, no, you don't have to pay him because the guy that brought the donkey onto the boat is a pursuer. He's like someone who's running after somebody else to murder him, right? He's a potential murderer who you're allowed to even kill him. And so certainly you can kill his donkey to save everybody's life. Rabba is following his own opinion that he says elsewhere. This is very important rules about property damage and killing in the in cases of pursuit. Rodef shaya rodef achad havero lehorgo v'shiber et hakelim ben shel nidaf ben shel kol adam patur sharei mitchayev benafsho. If you have a pursuer, evil guy, murderer, trying to go kill someone, and on the way he knocks over vessels and breaks them, and it doesn't matter whether they belong to the nidaf, the one being pursued, or anyone else, he does not have to pay. This is relevant to all the chase scenes in every movie, right? As the guy's chasing someone else, he also knocks into other things, he doesn't have to pay. Why? Because the rodef is liable to capital punishment. Anyone is permitted, even has a mitzvah, to stop him, even with his life. So since the rodef is liable to death, he doesn't get a second punishment at the same time of being liable to monetary penalty. So he doesn't have to pay for it. Now, how about the nirdaf? He's being pursued, right? And as he's being pursued, right, he's jumping over people's apple carts, knocking them over, smashing into cars as during the chase. What is he? Does he have to pay for all that damage? V'nirdaf shishibet hakelim shel rodef patur shelo yehem mamon mamono chaviv alav migufo aval shel kol adam chayav de'asu lehasil asmo b'mamon chavedo. So the one who's being pursued, who if he causes damage to the property of the rodef, right, he smashes into the rodef's own car, he does not have to pay, because a person's money should not be more valuable than his life. And since the pursuer, you can even kill him, right? He can, in self-defense, he can turn around and kill the pursuer. Certainly, he can destroy his property and not be liable. However, other people, just bystanders on the street that they knock into, the pursued has to pay, because although you're allowed to save your life, it's not that it's not that you have to stop and do nothing. You're allowed to knock over the guy's cart to put it in the way and get out, but then you still have to pay because you can't save your life at the expense of someone else's property. Now you have a lifesaver. You have a cop or a good Samaritan who is running after the pursuer, right, to save the victim. Okay, he's doing a good thing. Now, in the midst of it, he's got to also, you know, jump over bridges, flying cars, knock into things, and just cause damage as he's trying to get the pursuer. Whether he causes damage to the one pursued or anybody else, the good guy, cop, does not have to pay. Even though that's not technically the letter of the law, because really, the third party, what did he do, right? Why should he not get paid back? This guy who is rodef is a good rodef. He can't kill him. He's not mitchayev ben afsho. So really, he should have to pay. But you have to rule this way. Otherwise, no one is going to want to be a hero to save the day, right? If I know that, okay, I'm going to pursue this murderer and get him, but you know what? Then if I knock into a car on the way, I'm going to have to pay damages, and so now I'm going to be out, you know, could be a huge amount of money. In order to save, I'd rather not get involved. So we want to encourage people to get involved and save people's lives and go after pursuers. And therefore, even though it's not in line with the letter of the law, this is necessary to prevent such crimes from happening in the future. Mishnah, Shetafa Nahar, Omer Lo, Haresh Lecha Lefanecha. If a thief steals someone's land, which means you can't like pick up land and take it with you and put it in your pocket, you know, it means he went on someone's land and he's using the land, and then a flood, the river overflows and floods it and ruins it. So then the thief can say, well, here's your land. I don't have to pay you for the land that I stole because the land is right here. He could just leave and give the land and just leave the land as it is, and he doesn't have to pay for it. It's not his fault that it got flooded. It would have gotten flooded anyway.
Now
we see a baraita, and we learn that the Mishnah is actually only the opinion of Chachamim, but there's a machloket about this. Someone who steals someone else's field and it gets flooded, according to the Biel Azad, he really did steal it, right? Even though you can't pick it up and take it, but once the robber goes and starts using the field, he acquires it and he owes the owner a field. Since it gets damaged while it's in the possession of the robber has to pay another field just like it, because he stole it, so he's responsible. Chachamim, however, say no, you cannot steal a field. It's just there. You can trespass and the owner can kick you out, but you can't steal a field. It never belonged to the robber, and therefore when it gets destroyed, it's the owner's that gets flooded, and so the robber could say, here's your field, you know, go take it. B'mai kami palget. What's the source of their machloket? Rabbi Elazar darash ribuy meote v'chichesh b'amito ribuy pikadon mi'et. We've seen many times that there are two different ways of interpreting when the Torah gives a general and then the specific and then the general. How do you interpret it? So Rabbi Elazar is going to use ribuy and mi'ut. This is the basuk regarding shivata pikadon. If someone lies about something that he owes, he says, oh, what deposit? You never gave me anything. And then he's found, and he swears about it, and he's found out, so he has to pay the principal and a fifth, and also give a korban. We're not dealing with now with the swearing part, but just the fact that you have to return something. What kind of things do you have to return if you steal? When do you say it is actually acquired that you even stole it in the first place? That's what we're going to learn from this ribuy and mi'ut. So if someone lies to his friend, that's about anything. Pikadon is one example of a thing that you can steal. And then this is anything about which you lie, that's another generality. Whenever you have ribuy, mi'ut, ribuy, we're going to first start off with generalizing everything. So what are we going to include? Anything that you steal. So the mi'ut, what is it excluding? It's only excluding one thing. Financial documents. If I steal your financial document, a loan document, right? Let's say it's for $1,000. I don't have to pay you $1,000. All I stole was a piece of paper that's worth 1 cent. Okay, the fact that now you're going to have a harder time collecting it, it's not private. I didn't actually steal that $1,000. I only stole a document, and therefore I'm not responsible for the $1,000. That's what we're excluding, and everybody will agree with this case. However, Rabbanan take the same phrases, and they use Rabbi Ishmael's methodology. The previous one was what Rabbi Akiva usually used, and they say v'chichesh kelal v'pikadon perat o mikol chazar v'kalal kalal upratu klal iatadan ela ke'ayin haperat. So same words, and you have a general, specific general, and in this case, you don't only remove one item, but rather anything that is similar in some essential detail to that particular. So just like the example of a pikadon is something that's movable and is worth, has intrinsic monetary value, so to anything that is movable and has intrinsic monetary value. That excludes land. That's the big thing here. See, Chachamim exclude land from something that you can steal and would have to pay back. You can trespass on land, but you can't actually take land and steal it. And therefore, doesn't belong to the robber when he takes it, and when it gets destroyed, he can just leave and say, here it is. It's not mine. It's not my problem. So that's where he's excluding karkaot, because not like a pikadon in that it cannot be moved. Also excluded are slaves, that because slaves have the same status as land, the same laws apply to them. And also he's going to exclude legal documents, and that's an agreement, because even though they can be carried, they're movable items, but they have no intrinsic monetary value. It's only a pointer to an IOU. Now we challenge.
We have
a similar braita, but this time it's talking about a cow. Someone who steals a cow, and then a river washes it away and kills the cow. The thief has to provide another cow, according to the Bi Elazar. However, Chachamim say, no, he could say, here's your cow, it's not my problem. So this is strange, because a cow, it seems like this is something that is movable and has intrinsic value, and therefore he should have to return the cow, right? The Bi Elazar makes sense. And certainly the Bi Elazar, he only excluded one thing, financial documents. So certainly, according to Bi Elazar, you have to return the cow. Chachamim, a cow is not land, it's not a financial document, it's not a slave, it's a movable item that has intrinsic value. How come the robber doesn't have to go buy another cow and replace the value of the cow?
Rabbi
explains that this braita is not talking about he stole a cow by itself, but rather that he stole a field from his friend, and there happened to be a cow that was lying down on the field. So when he stole the land, so the cow just came along with it. And then the river came and flooded it. So the Bi Elazar, it follows his own opinion. Yes, you have to provide, you have to replace the land and the cow. You have to replace everything. But Rabbanan follow their own opinion that say, since he never acquired the cow, he never acquired the land, so he didn't acquire the cow that was on the land either. So he never actually stole anything. And therefore, when the flood comes, the robber can just walk away and says, here's your cow, here's your land, and he does not have to pay for it. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen v'amen.